Hi.
Hi.
So, what's this book about?
You didn't read this one either?
Well, I was gonna, but I accidentally read something else.
What?
Vogue.
I hated the book, all right? I have no idea what it's about, and the writer was clearly on drugs when he wrote it. I mean, it went on and on and on like it was written in a total hurry. If I handed in something like this, there's no way I'd get a good grade on it. I mean, it's boring and it's unorganized. And I only read 30 pages of it anyway.
Well, that was passionate, albeit entirely misinformed.
Who dares follow Miss Kelly's lucid analysis?
It's required reading.
With Tom and Stella, episode 100.
Whoa!
Our favorites, tangent special. Hello and welcome to Required Reading with Tom and Stella, a podcast that's brought to you by the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network. This podcast is all about books and literature, and each month we take a thorough look at one piece of literature we have both read and determine whether it's required reading. However, it is one of our tangent specials, which we do every 10 episodes, and it is our 100th episode. So what Stella and I have decided to do is talk about some of our favorite books, top five, as well as favorites in certain genres, subgenres, categories, etc., etc. So, I've already mentioned her. Please say hello to Stella.
Hello, can you believe we made it this far without unaliving each other?
Yes, this is true. We're just completely ghosting each other and letting things pod fade.
Yeah. That'd be so sad.
That would be sad.
Do we have the longest running show on the network?
No.
Okay.
No. Back to the Bins has been on for Back to the Bins has gotta be 15 years at least, maybe even longer. The main show of Two True Freaks itself has a lot of episodes, so we're not, but we are up there as well. Pop Culture Affidavit has more than 100 episodes itself. So I'm at 161, which is coming out 161 is coming out next week. So this is still an accomplishment, and you gotta think, you and I both know what it's like to coordinate with other people when you're recording something. Although I will say, because sometimes I have issues trying to get myself to record a solo show, and doing this like on a schedule every month has been really helpful.
That's good.
Yeah.
Yeah. And typically the same Tuesday, unless we move things from time to time.
Yeah. So, So you're keeping me honest here, and I also don't want to let you down. So,
sure.
Or at least, I don't want to let you down in this way.
In this way, yes, there are other ways, like liking Starfire. We've talked about it before, but definitely podcasting is a partnership, and you have to be able to trust the other person. So and I feel like, looking back over 99 episodes, that we've had some really great picks, a couple that we haven't liked, but it's also good to get that literature out there and try things.
I like, we've done a pretty, I didn't run data or numbers on the picks that we've had, but we've had our fair share of trying to like cast as wide a net as possible too. Not to pat ourselves on the back here, but it just seems like we really aren't going to pick anything that we're really interested in on that particular moment, and I like that about it. We're not sticking to a specific, list anymore. There's no sequence here, and I think I like the randomness of the picks, because it keeps the show fresh, as opposed to having to, like, because you've done a comics index show, And
Yes.
I've done one. And you know those stretches of a run that you're like, I have to get through this. So like it can get a little stale because it's like, I want to, there's like maybe this set of issues like for a year or so. It's just these aren't as good, but you have to cover them. And I don't feel like we have that with this show because it's not the way it's designed. So it's kind of nice to always be able to come and say like, okay, we're doing something and it's hopefully going to be interesting every time instead of like predictable.
Yeah,
So
absolutely. You never know what we're going to choose.
how are you doing? I know it's been a while. I knew back and forth. I think you texted me the other day. I think it was the first time you texted me like 2 or 3 weeks.
Oh,
It's
no.
just
That
been
sounds so
busy. It's just
sad.
been very
It
busy is all
has
it is.
been very busy. And I, yeah, the past couple months for me have been kind of podcast fatigue, just with specials on Back of the Oracle and then Dear Reader. So I guess I've just been kind of nose to the grindstone. Doing well. I started taking Italian lessons Monday nights. So hoping to maybe be have some level of fluency the next time I go back.
Yeah,
So
cool.
that's been like the biggest, I guess, life update. But otherwise things are just, yeah, trucking along and making our way through like the doldrums, I think, just the really long winter months where I think student fatigue reaches an all-time high and you're like trying to engage them and it's really hard. So yeah, but otherwise, life is good beyond America blowing up.
Yeah, this is solace in
Yeah.
the apocalypse here.
Yeah,
So
but hey, we do have the Gulf of America now, so all things aren't bad.
Oh yes. 'Cause that solves all of our problems.
Yeah, we're gonna get Greenland soon.
Oh
Like,
yeah.
lots of stuff is happening, and I think the Gaza Strip is gonna be made into some sort of resort. Like, lots of things are on the horizon for us that I'm super excited about.
Dripping with sarcasm. Anyway, yeah. So at least hopefully for the next hour and a half or so, or however long this takes, you, the audience, and you, Stella, will be able to kind of escape things for a little bit and just enjoy it because we certainly have enjoyed putting this out. Now, I don't think we've enjoyed every minute of editing the show, but
No.
that's like the one thing as a podcaster that I just like. I think I procrastinate on that more than anything, if I'm being completely honest with you. So,
Yep.
I gotta edit. So, yeah. But yeah. So, to get on topic, we are just kind of doing an episode about favorites. And we decided to choose like kind of like our top five favorite books. Which we'll start with that and we'll kind of alternate between our five. And then we decided to just kind of break things into categories. And we have just a bunch of like a list of categories, like you would see at your local bookstore and stuff. And like, okay, like what's your favorite in there? And stuff. And just kind of talk about books that we really, really love and we would love to recommend to people, with the caveat that these lists always change. So, I could very well like choose something for this particular category and the next week or like, oh, why didn't I mention that book or something like that, we'll talk a little bit about why we like the books and stuff like that. So nothing here is set in stone, but they're all ones we like. So I guess we should just go ahead and get it started. And we'll start by doing a 5 through 1 countdown of those top five. And Stella, I'm going to let you go first. So, what's your number five?
Yeah, my number five, I mean, might as well just start off super controversial, super cancel worthy, but it would be disingenuous of me if this were not on my list because my list here was hard. I think Tom will also say his was difficult. Like three were kind of locked in, but then two, I was like, oh, I don't know. But I really thought about this list of which ones have been like so formative on me at different times. And I think all of the books that I've chosen, not only this list, but then my tops of the genres are also true. And it would be a lie if I didn't include this. So it's Gone with the Wind. by Margaret Mitchell. Okay. I realize, I recognize, I understand that this is a problematic novel. And I will also say, I won't say, but I will also say that for me, it was very formative. I read this when I was a junior in high school. So it's been like 20 years. And it was probably the largest book that I had read. And I just feel like if every sort of region has a sweeping epic, you know, countries, I think, have certain epics too that they're related to. We've, of course, talked about Homer and his relation to Greece. I think, you know, Virgil has done that for Rome. You have Les Mis, I think, for France, War and Peace for Russia,
yeah,
right?
I was going to say.
I feel like Gone with the Wind is the epic for, you know, the southern region of the United States. Obviously, it highlights and glorifies things that are not the best. But I think it does give you a peek into what the mindset was like about the Confederacy at that point in time. So I think it's a good window to a certain extent. And honestly, I love Scarlett O'Hara. She is super flawed, but she is just really, I think, a really intriguing character. The little blurb I got is, you know, this is the tale of Scarlett O'Hara, the spoiled, manipulative daughter of a wealthy plantation owner. And I'm like, yeah, all of that is 100% true. But just watching her throughout the entire novel go from someone who's like super entitled and never really leaves that behind, but how she finds herself in these situations where she has to save other people and save Tara and what she has to do, and that she doesn't rely on other people necessarily, but it's on her, like she takes it on her. I just feel like she is a really powerful female protagonist that is super flawed. Yeah, so I think it's just like a glimpse into the past. Obviously, it did come up in our The Outsiders. Mm-hmm. But I I do recognize that it's flaw, but I think flaws. But I think literature wise and like writing style, I do think it is like really beautifully written. But it's been 20 years, so I need to probably revisit that. I don't know if that's a show that we're going to do. So that's why I put at the fifth, because I don't want to like tout it like this is so amazing, because I think that is problematic. But like I said, I would be lying if I did not have that on the list, because of I think it is one of the reasons why it pushed me to love literature, that as well as Jane Eyre. And I think Scarlett O'Hara is just an example of a character that you can love, but also really have issues with, and just the complexities of female characters at the time. So that is why it is my number five.
I have only, funny enough, I've only ever seen the most famous moments of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
I've never actually sat down and watched all of Gone with the Wind. I certainly haven't read it. So my knowledge of the movie is like secondhand through people who are fans of it, or just like through, you know, movie clips and things like that. So I know some of the more famous scenes and things like that, and stuff like that. You know, her coming down the stairs and et cetera. So cool. And I actually am not surprised, because I know you've been a fan of this novel for a long time. So yeah. I'm not surprised it's on your list at all. So, my number five, choosing the number four and number five books were like the hardest part of this. Cause my top three were kind of set. Two and three kind of kept shifting positions, but,
mm-hmm.
But like four and five, I like literally had four books.
Ugh.
And I was trying to decide for them. So the two honorable mentions, which I won't go into, I'll just mention them, that were To Kill a Mockingbird and The Great Gatsby. Mm. Neither of which we've done yet. We probably will get around to. And I know Mockingbird fell off there pretty quickly, but this number five and Gatsby kind of fought it out. And it's another book that a number of people don't like, yet I do. And we have discussed, and it should come as no shock to anybody who's listened to the show or known me, that The Catcher in the Rye is on my list, and it's the number five. You know, I read it, as we talked about when we were in, I don't remember what episode we did before, but I first read this my junior year of high school, like a lot of people in my generation did. And it's not as taught as widely as it used to be, because I think just other more contemporary works have supplanted it, or there's been, they've taken American literature in other directions as far as the curriculum goes, which is perfectly fine, because I've seen some of the books that have supplanted it. I'm like, oh, those are really, really good. But, you know, it hit me at the right time. It hit me at the right time and the right age. It's one of those works where, like, you know, you're this, you know, 16 year old kid in the suburbs and stuff. Young adult literature as it exists now did not exist in 1993 or 1994 when I first read it, because it was not, you know, so we have a lot of stuff that actually owes itself to both The Outsiders and Catcher in the Rye as far as the YA stuff is concerned. But to me, there's something, and I've said this before, there's something very punk rock about this book, about the just the being pissed off at the world, and not being fully able to explain it. And then there's this depth to the character of Holden Caulfield that took me a long time to find, because I reread it at different ages. And I have empathy for him. There are times when I'm frustrated by him, incredibly frustrated by him. And there are times where I really feel a lot of sympathy for him. And I think that is the mark of an outstanding character. You know, your characters don't need to be heroes, and the disaffected inner conflict types should not be perfect. And I think that sometimes that gets lost when we talk about like the type of character we want to identify with. And we talk about that when we talk about teen characters, there seems to be this desire for them to be, to not be as flawed or not be as frustrating, or for you not to hate them in some ways. But it's okay with him, because I think he's designed that way. He's written that way. And the situation is, I mean, it's really well written. The dialogue, the story beats, his narration, the character of Phoebe, I mean, all these things are great. And it comes to this head at the end that you really get, like, from his grieving his brother, his being frustrated with the world, his parents don't care about him at all, you know, and it comes to a head at the end there. And I really have always liked this. And, you know, I went through phases with the book where, like, there was probably a time in my 20s or something was like, oh, well, screw Salinger. He's not as good as everybody says he is, because I was probably around too many J.D. Salinger stands. And I was just like, all right, you know, enough. And I came back to the book, and then having been here and there on TikTok, which I actually don't have on my phone anymore, I ran across a lot of people just crapping on this book, and they never really had a reason for it beyond really superficial and shallow reasons, or the most shallow of it all. I had to read this in high school and I hated it. It's like, bite me. but really, like, I found myself defending it more and more. And then I'm glad we had reread it for the show, because I just, like, there's a lot of depth to this book that I think doesn't get the credit for. And like I said in the episode, I think you have to read this because there's so many characters in our popular culture whose origin point is right here. And I think without Holden Caulfield, you don't really get a lot of the angry teenage boy characters, or the disaffected teenager characters, or they would have come about in a different way. But I think that him being kind of an archetype for that character is important. So yeah, The Catcher in the Rye, it's number five.
There you go. Which was spotlighted? Well, I don't even know. On required reading at some point.
Yeah.
Yeah. I remember you sent out a survey to see why people didn't like it.
Why don't you like Holden Caulfield? Or why don't you like
it? Yeah. One of the 10th grade classes in English read this, but not all of them. So I think it depends on the teacher. But yeah. Yeah, I guess without him, no angsty teenagers, huh?
In a way, yeah. I'm sure it would have come around at some point, but it would have definitely been different, and such. So, yeah. All right, Stella, number four.
Number four. Yes, 4 and 3 were tough for me. I will say honorable mention for me, man, I really love Lessons in Chemistry by Bonnie Garmus. And that's another story with a female protagonist that I think shows realism in what women, how they were treated in the 60s. And then something that just, I think, continues today. But it didn't make it, even though I still somewhat regret it. But my number 4 is East of Eden by John Steinbeck. And this was, I read it in 2019 in the summer at Orvieto, and I think Italy, and also in Spain. It was like my summer read. And so the blurb for this was, this sprawling and often brutal novel set in the rich farmlands of California's Salinas Valley follows the intertwined destinies of two families, the Trasks and the Hamiltons, whose generations helplessly reenact the fall of Adam and Eve and the poisonous rivalry of Cain and Abel. I think I first found out about East of Eden, I just had randomly seen a terrible scene of the film where I think the female protagonist and gosh, what's his name?
Was James Dean in
that? Yeah, James Dean were like outside of a train, and then the brother was on the train and is like looking out, and he starts hitting his head against the glass of the train and the glass is breaking. It's like very psychotic. But this, I guess all I can say is like family melodrama and just something that like shocking things happen that you just don't expect. And it's long, and yet it crosses generations. And I've tried generational novels. Like, I'm not really big on the 100 Years of Solitude. I didn't really get into that. But this one, I was just locked in. And this was, I think, also the novel that really cemented John Steinbeck as like top 2 or 3 authors for me, and just wanting to read everything that he was writing. We of course did Of Mice and Men on this show. I had listened to Grapes of Wrath at one point. So yeah, I can't, you know, it's unfortunate just because I remember it so fondly, but like the details sort of escape me because of all the books that I have read now after that. But I just so recommend this novel just with the language itself, and you just get so wrapped up in the family and really caring about them that with the tragedies that hit, you like really feel it. And there are a few novels that I get so engrossed in that I'm like aching for the people. So yeah, it's just like a modern day telenovela or soap opera with the stuff that goes down, but it's written so well, it doesn't seem like it's fluff. Like, there's actual point to it.
Yeah, I read it like 20 years ago, and I remember really enjoying it. And I also love The Grapes of Wrath, so we will have to revisit. We'll probably visit both of those at some point. But no, that's a really, really strong pick. I really do like that book. So cool. Mine is another one that we've covered. Whoa. Actually, all but one of my top 5 we've actually covered on the show. I just realized it's like, okay, but I have covered one of them on a podcast. So I've covered all 5 of these in some form on a podcast. This one is the most recently published of them, although I think the book was published back in like the mid 2000s or so. So it's not like exactly contemporary, but it's a book that I keep coming back to. I think I've read or listened to this book like 3 or 4 times now, and I love it every time I do. And it's probably, I guess, the most popular piece or something like, or the most popular fiction type of piece, and that is World War Z. Whoa. By Max Brooks. I just, you know, we read this, and like I said, it has that beautifully done full cast recording audiobook. I think I've read this 3 or 4 times now. Every time, it just has me in its grip. It's gripping, and it's Brooks doing something that you don't get in a format in fiction very often, like the oral history, which really lays out like a global zombie apocalypse on a way that we're not used to seeing, because up until then, most of the time when you saw the zombie movie was contained to like one place or something. Usually because those movies had like no budget, so you had to shoot it in a house or a shopping mall or something like that. And The Walking Dead, I know, had like kind of the bigger picture as far as some of the other things are concerned, but this really, really looked at the whole world, the global scale, and was biting in its satire of certain things, and had the subtle political and not so subtle political commentary in others, and really captured how people probably would react in those moments. I thought that one of the best plot points for me is that's like the most prescient was the whole idea that like they were selling this drug called Phalanx, and it was just like this fake snake oil zombie vaccine that people were like wearing in the United States and stuff, and it just and people thought they were okay, and then you have like, I think it was called the Great Panic, where like everything falls apart like within like a short period of time, and the United States just goes completely, you know, is taken over and such. And there's so many great stories from so many different people, and the fact that he could manage a cast of characters like that and have them be distinct personalities and just string it through this kind of journalist who isn't really a character himself. He's just kind of the reporter, was a brilliant way to do it. Because it made it really fresh in a way that, I think telling this straightforward as a novel wouldn't have worked. And honestly, the only other time I've seen that done really, really well in a novel form is Daisy Jones and the Six. So, but Brooks really, it's an outstanding book. And I've recommended that book in the audiobook more times than I can count, especially the audiobook when people talk about audiobooks. So yeah, World War Z.
I almost put this as my top horror. I was considering doing that, but it did not make my list. But I second it that it is, yeah, it's really good. I would say the movie doesn't hold.
No, the movie's just Brad Pitt being
Brad
Pitt.
It is just Brad Pitt. I would say the best scene is like him in the hospital wing trying to get something because it was very suspenseful. Mm-hmm. But other than that, it wasn't really worth it. And yeah, I think it's just such an interesting take on the zombie genre, and doing it like a reporter, I thought was pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. All right, so we're up to number three.
What
is it?
In passing, I may have mentioned this, The Count of Monte Cristo by Alexander Dumas. Yeah. And the blurb: thrown in prison for a crime he has not committed, Edmond Dantès is confined to the grim fortress of If. There he learns of a great hoard of treasure hidden on the Isle of Monte Cristo, and he becomes determined not only to escape, but also to unearth the treasure and use it to plot the destruction of the three men responsible for his incarceration. I will say, so for me, films and books have something in common, where if it's a really long film, let's take The Brutalist, for example, which was 3.5 hours. Plus a 15-minute intermission. Ugh. Or a book that might be like 1,000 pages long. You have to ask yourself, did it need to be that long? The Brutalist, no, I don't recommend going to go see that. But The Count of Monte Cristo, I did not feel this page length at all. Another super engrossing novel. This was, I think everything on my list is because of Rory Gilmore's reading list. So hashtag Gilmore Girls. But this one was, I distinctly remember reading this my first year working at my previous school, being on lunch duty and like reading it. And just like those pieces, just like a couple chapters at a time, just really loving the adventure that you were witness to. And also like this tale of revenge. And, you know, we talk about Batman all the time and just like, you know, is he going to give it up? Is this kind of toxic for him? But you've got this guy who has been betrayed by a good friend of his. And so now he has this revenge plot. And so you kind of think about, when should the revenge end? When should there be forgiveness? Like there's really strong themes there. Do the people get their comeuppance and everything? But yeah, it's a fun, kind of a swashbuckler. Obviously there's a lot of time in prison, so there's a lot of thinking But yeah, I just never felt the page count. And I think that every word that was written needed to be written, and really enjoy this. Again, it's been a long time. It's been a long time since I've read this. So I more remember my feelings than like specific details. But I highly recommend this. And yeah, just I think formative, since that's kind of the theme of my side of the episode, in the fact that I think as I was tackling Rory Gilmore's reading list, and I was lucky enough to pick these good ones in the beginning, like it just gave me the forbearance to make it through, and also just open my eyes to this literature that if I was more focused on modern stuff, like now I'm taking a peek in the past and seeing like how worthwhile the classics are and why they're called the classics. So that's why The Count of Monte Cristo is my number three.
Oh, cool. You know, I've never read that. I don't know why. I just, it's one, you know, it's, you know, sometimes you don't read a book because like I have no interest in whatever it is. But in this case, and this is true for some genres of me, it's just never been on my radar. So maybe I might have to check that one out, because it's a blind spot, because you did a very, very good job of describing it and such. Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it would be one of, if we chose to do it here, it'd be kind of like the Don Quixote thing.
Okay.
Where we tell each other like 3 months in advance that we're going to do it. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. My number three is kind of a, it's from an epic standpoint, I guess, or an epic time, but at the same time, or a very, very tumultuous time, but is more personal than novel. It is a book I covered on another podcast of mine.
Oh.
And if you want to go hear that, I think it's episode, like 29 or 30 of In Country. And which is over on the Two True Freaks website. It's not on a feed anymore. But my number three is a book that I've taught. I taught for a number of years when I taught 10th grade. And it's easily one of the, if not the greatest war novel of all time, and that is All Quiet on the Western Front by Eric Maria Remarque. I first read this my first year of teaching at my former school because we were was just looking for something to teach the sophomores, and there was a unit available on it. I'd never read the book before. I had always heard of it. I'd heard of the Oscar-winning Best Picture movie, which was done in the early, like 1931 or so. So I picked up a copy out of the book room and started a little slow. And then I think within a couple of chapters, I was like, I couldn't put the book down. And I grew up reading and watching things and playing war. You know, like I grew up in the G.I. Joe, Real American Hero era, and Star Wars and Aliens and, Missing in Action and Rambo and like that era of entertainment in the 80s. So the idea of war was not foreign to me, even though the concept of war as far as a real life thing actually was, because we weren't in any sort of conflict when I was younger. But I read this and I'm reading something that's like in the head of this kid who, like his other classmates and all the people he's serving with, march off to war with their heads held high and singing the patriotic songs to fight for the fatherland, because Remarque was German. And he's essentially been duped by like the Cantorek, the teacher, who tells them they have to go fight for the glory of the country. And then they, you know, they are quickly, you know, they go through basic training, and they have, there's the colonel the drill sergeant Himmelstoss, who is just this little, you know, bastard of a drill sergeant, who they eventually get back. And then they're just faced with the brutality of World War One. And honestly, this led to me being really interested in World War One, because I really didn't know much beyond Snoopy and the Red Baron. So, I mean, I knew a little bit more, but I mean, really did not, because you're not taught a lot about World War One in the United States, because we were in it for like a year and a half, right? So learning about all of these things and how just brutal the war was and how many people would die in one battle and no territory would shift or a little bit would shift. And there was this stalemate and they were just sending these guys over the bars into no man's land. And it having Paul Bauer as the narrator. So you're from this point of view of this person really drives home what this did to a generation of young men. And there's a poem that I would always use along with it. And I'm going to butcher this Latin. I apologize. Dulce et decorum est.
Oh, dear. Oh, dear.
Yeah, so.
Dulce. It's a hard C, yeah.
Okay, the Italian in me. Dulce et decorum est. Per patriam mori is the whole line. It's basically good and right to die for your country. Mm-hmm. And the poem is like him going through this whole graphic description of like mustard gas attack. At the end, he said, if you had seen what he looked like when, I'm not going to quote it directly, but he said, if you hadn't seen what he looked like when we threw him in the truck or whatever, the grave, you would not be telling the old lie. Dulce et decorum est per patriam mori. Like, you know, it's this bitterness, and All Quiet on the Western Front has that. It has this sadness to it. There's this chapter 6 or 7, they meet these girls, and it's supposed to be this, like, you know, they hook up with them, but like as he's with this girl, he thinks of the only times he's ever been with girls were like brothels, and it's just this sadness of his youth and innocence being stolen from him in that way. And on the other side, though, there are some very funny moments, and Remarque also gets into like the boring day-to-day things about the war, about warfare and service and things like that. And it's a really, and I'm rambling, it's a really kind of whole picture of this, of a war as hell type of thing that really takes you in the audience. And I don't care if it's from a German author showing German soldiers in the First World War, it really is universal. And I think, honestly, everybody should read it.
No, I've never read it.
It's really good.
Apparently, yes. Well, how you were talking almost reminded me of The Reader. I mean, obviously, it's a different thing, but just a German sort of reflecting on that period of time. Well, yeah. You speak so highly, I guess I'll have to put on the list or just wait until you make us read it for this show.
I don't know if I will. The episode I did on In Country was like really extensive. So I'm putting that aside because I covered it in depth. So, and maybe a little while down the road, maybe. But there are tons of other books we could read. All right. So we're down to our top two.
Number two.
What's your number two, Stella?
Yes, number two we covered on this particular show. It is a book that there are a few books that I just will recommend to anybody because I trust it that much and I believe in it that much and I love it that much. And in this one, it is LMNOP by Mark Dunn. If you recall, I don't know that I need to say this blurb, but just remember that LMNOP is living on this fictional island of Nollop, and Nollop is named after Nevin Nollop, who was the author of The Quick Brown Fox Jumps Over the Lazy Dog, and the tiles, there's a statue for him, and there are tiles that say that phrase, and then the tiles start falling, and some of the people believe that this is a sign that they need to excise those particular letters from their vocabulary. And so, yeah, you're not allowed to use those. And it's a novel in letters, which is not my typical genre, because I did try another one and I did not like it. And we also had the journals with the Dracula. So I'm touch and go on these. But this one I did like. And I just love the cleverness of, number one, the conceit. And number two, how Dunn is able to make the language work. Because as the novel goes on, like, language is devolving. You have to figure out other words. You have to use synonyms to figure, you know, if you can't use particular letters because people get in trouble. And then if they have enough strikes, they get exiled from the area. And then it just is like almost caveman speak with how they're having to work through and send missives. And there's kind of a rebellious plot and everything. So I think this really hits me hard again, the formation, because I'm a linguist, and language is really important to me and grammar is really important to me. And so this is a, you know, a novel about language and the importance of it. And I just think it's really wonderful. And then on the other side, I think, which is probably scarily, relevant to today is, you know, governmental control and how, you know, some people might get an idea and that idea might be a little wackadoodle, but some people buy into it and then it you can kind of see how it starts to destroy a community. So it's got like both sides of that, and definitely something I would call maybe a like satirical to a certain extent, but mm-hmm. it's just, yeah, and it is not long. I would say it's less than 200, though I don't have my copy with me right now. And I think he's really efficient with his and economical with his words and what he's doing. So yeah, that's my number two, LMNOP.
I remember really liking that book, and I like how it did tackle language in a way that I think is just as good, if not better, in places than like Orwell doing Newspeak in 1984. You know, I thought that, and I liked how he took what could have been a cheesy gimmick and really made it work. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that, no, I really, really liked that book. That's a great pick. All right. My number two, a book we also covered, a book I'm actually preparing to teach again starting next week. And it is really, like, truly one of my favorite books of all time. And that is Mary Shelley's Frankenstein.
Ooh.
Oh, I love this book. I love the, again, a flawed protagonist. I always talk about, I always use Victor Frankenstein as an example for my students, as you don't have to like your main character. He doesn't have to be likable. He just has to be compelling, or the story has to be compelling. And Victor Frankenstein is like the perfect example of an unlikable protagonist. You can sympathize with him, you can empathize with him sometimes, but he's just so, like, the hubris and a lot of his flaws really come back to haunt him in a big way. The monster is wonderfully written, and his journey of educating himself and trying to figure out who he is, and just kind of the sadness that exists in him from the rejection that turns into the anger at his creator, is well put. And then it raises all sorts of questions in terms of our moral compass, ethics, what we should and should not do in the name of industry, technology, or science, and the consequences of doing that. You know, everything happens to people around Victor until it finally will happen to him. And I think that's one of the more important things, like that your hubris has consequences beyond just you getting hurt. It will hurt other people. And sometimes those people are often people who you really care about. And I think Shelley, it's hard to say anything. She just nails it. Every bit of that book is just so good. And it's a 200-year-old novel that has never lost its shine and never lost its relevance. And there's a reason it's so iconic in our popular culture. And I'm really excited about teaching it again, starting next week when we start, in a week or two, when we start our Frankenstein unit. And it is just an amazing book for all the reasons I think anybody ever says.
I will say that this was my pick for science fiction. Yes.
Cool.
Which was a tough category for me to narrow down, to be honest.
Me too.
But I enjoyed this when I read it. I think maybe I've read it twice, but talking with you about it always makes things more enjoyable as well. And yeah, you don't expect to feel much empathy for as much empathy as you do for the monster, but he deserves it. He tried the best he could. But no, it is really interesting. And you know, part of me is like, a woman did this. Isn't that amazing? Isn't it awesome?
Oh yeah.
Especially since I think, you know, her husband ? Was not the best of mess of guy.
Yeah, well, he died young too.
Yeah.
And also, if you had to spend a weekend in Geneva with Lord Byron, you'd escape probably by writing a novel too. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think just such an amazing feat, I think, to be remembered for this, which, yeah.
Yeah. She was like 18 too. All right, Stella, why don't you give us your top pick?
You know, you say that and then remember that S.E. Hinton was 16.
Yeah, I was not writing this crap when I was, I was writing crap when I was 16.
Don't you feel
that.
Like a failure?
I feel like a failure every day. So that just rubs salt in the wound. So anyway, yes, we're up to our number one. So what is your number one pick?
Yes, I think people would be shocked if I didn't say this as my number one pick, but it is Jane Eyre by Charlotte Bronte. Another super formative novel for me, around the same time that I read Gone with the Wind, and really what an amazing think piece to pit Jane up against Scarlett O'Hara, and the stark contrast that would show us of female characters. But this was, you know, it's not an easy novel, as I think you can attest, Thomas, since I made you read it. But the beauty of the language and really setting the scene and having you live it almost with its imagery and following Jane and her struggles, both external as well as internal, and just such an amazing, I think, female character and someone that, you know, I look up to in regards to holding strong to your values. And yes, this also has some problematic elements to it. But it's also, like a sweeping romance as well. And it's a gothic romance, which is one of my favorite genres. And, you know, Helen Burns, may she rest in peace. Yeah, I mean, I've done a whole season of it on Dear Reader. We've talked about it, so I don't need to go on and on. But this is just something that, again, I think pushed forward my love of literature, because once I read it, I was like, oh, wow, these are, you know, this is what literature is. This is what a classic is. And it also helped me like, oh, wow, I can read difficult things. Cause you know, I read at the end of high school, and sometimes it's hard reading in school because it's quick sometimes. And you know, you might be, I don't know, not understanding things as well. I mean, I struggled with the Scarlet Letter, to be honest. Part of, you know, I'll say 50-50, part of it was, you know, me just not understanding it. Part of it was the teacher was not the best. And I was just so frustrated one day. And my mom said, like, do you want to know who or with whom Hester Prynne had the affair? Like, because then everything connected. And she told me, I was like, okay, this makes sense. So just to say that, like, I struggle too. And so sometimes when you struggle with something and you might see other people like breezing through it, you're like, oh my gosh, you know, am I dumb? But this was like, I struggled through it, but I made it and I understood it and I wrestled with it and saw the beauty of it. And so it's really something that has formed me as a lover of literature and someone that continually tries to find difficult novels and not give up if I'm having trouble with it, but like push through.
All right. I always tell my AP students that they should read something from this era because the College Board loves the Brontes. So
there you go. Yep.
Yeah. So we're doing romanticism right now, actually. So, okay. I will give you mine then. So number one, and actually, I think I literally said this on the episode where we handled this book, and it's been my favorite novel for a very long time. And that is Fahrenheit 451 by Ray Bradbury.
Whoa.
Yeah. Which is now a work of nonfiction.
Yikes.
No, I mean, this is so, like, I like to say that, I was talking to a student about this last year. We were talking about dystopian books, and he was asking me what I thought of Brave New World versus 1984. And I tend to fall on the side of 1984, as though I thought Brave New World had its things. But I said, I think what Bradbury does, and this is one of the things I like, is that he takes the best of both of those books and puts them into one book. So you have a society that is a totalitarian thing where the police are going after people and spying on people, etc. you know, reading, of course, it's the books have been banned, the firemen burned the books, etc. But the populace is numbed by entertainment. There's an epidemic of people trying to kill themselves with sleeping pills because they don't know how to, because the emotion that they're putting down by numbing themselves up by the entertainment is not escaping in the right way. So they're self-destructive or destructive in different ways. There's so many kids running around and like speeding in cars and things like that. So the society, it is very dystopian in the sense that it, on the surface, it probably looks really nice. At least with the kind of like, you know, the type of where materialism is a big part of it. And, you know, his wife wants a third wall or whatever for the parlor and all these things. And it really is all about consumption in many ways. But beneath it, it is everything is rotten to the point where like even the people who are in charge of enforcing these laws are not just jaded, but actually rebelling. And the idea that, you know, toward the end, he becomes the keeper of one of the books of the Bible. And I don't remember which one it was. I was like Deuteronomy or Ecclesiastes or something. And the idea that you keep, that it becomes part of you is like really, really important. Something we're losing even in our modern society, because like, you know, there are a lot of people and are kind of like you and me and a lot of our friends and people we know who do read and love, you know, books. And we hate some, some of them are disposable and we cherish others, right? Just like you do with any form of entertainment. And they really speak to us. And it's less and less of people are like on a regular basis are as into it. Like, you know, there are a lot of people these days who you go into their house and you never see books anywhere. And I think Bradbury really tapped into that, and he saw what was happening with the way people were consuming things and their entertainment, and he saw what was happening with censorship and political zeal, and really in the 50s created a book that was subversive in a way that and also incredibly, believe it or not, easy to read. It's a slim book. It's like 165 pages or something. It's not a very long book. And it really is succinct and very economical in the way it tells its story. And I think it's really, really good that way. And just and also like we came around from when I read that in high school and all of the gadgetry was still kind of futuristic to the point where most of those gadgets exist, even the robot dog. And that's kind of scary too. And so it's something that I didn't want to come true in the same way that another science fiction novel that was dystopian novel that we read, I don't want to come true either. But it is, I think honestly, it is like one of the definitions of required reading for me. Like you should read this book if you are interested in like the future of the country. So yeah, Fahrenheit 451 is my favorite book of all time.
There you go. Almost made it on my list of top science fiction, but yes. Nice. I enjoyed it. That was not, I think one of the, yeah, I mean, we're rehashing territory, I suppose, yeah, since we've already covered it. But yeah, one of the classes read that, but we read, I think, Of Mice and Men instead. So I never had that opportunity in high school, but I was glad that it was on for Gilmore's reading list and got to tackle it. But yeah, speculative fiction is interesting because you don't want it to be speculative. You just want it to be fiction. But when you see things that are, you know, a little too close for comfort, it's really interesting. And, you know, given what the Nazis did with books.
Yeah.
You know, to have that set in a world, you know, similar to ours is really scary. And like you said, yeah, it's kind of, getting even more scarily relevant. Yeah. So I enjoy it. And, you know, always having someone fight against, which is appreciated. You know, there's always somebody that goes against the grain. And I always appreciate nonconformists.
The fact that the rebellion starts in many cases subconsciously. Like he starts to do these things and he's doing it. And then it becomes more and more overt where he finally takes the risk to go find somebody who can help him is brilliant as well. because it's I think he I like that about this, the book too. Okay, so we are gonna go through. Yeah, so we have a list, and honestly, like, there's no rhyme or reason as to the order of this list. I think we just wrote down as many genres as we could find that came to the top of our heads, so it's going to jump all over the place. But what we're going to do is similar to what we just did with the top five, and we'll mention the genre, we'll say what favorite book we have, maybe if you have one or two others that you just want to give an honorable mention to, because I know and I'm pretty sure that you as well, for some of these it was really hard to pick one thing. Science fiction, horror, YA are like three that I can think off the top of my head where I'm like, I have like five books on this list right now and I have to narrow it down to one, you know. But yeah, and we'll talk a little bit about the book that we've chose for it. And I'm going to pick a book for our first genre is historical fiction. And I think this qualifies as historical fiction because it is taking place in the past, as from when it was written, although it is the fairly recent past. So it's not like it's going back to the, you know, ancient Rome or medieval times or anything, but I wanted to include this book somewhere. And I think this is the best place for it. So if I'm technically wrong, I apologize, but I can't let this go by without mentioning Tim O'Brien's The Things They Carried, which is, if you're not familiar with it, is a novel about the Vietnam War. O'Brien himself was a Vietnam vet. He wrote the book and published it in the early 90s or something like that. And what it is, it's a series of interconnecting stories that can be read independently or read as a full book. And he tells an outstanding war story. He dips into horror, some romantic pieces. There's some very sad moments. There's what this effect had affected had on the veterans who served, and really is kind of the standard for Vietnam War novels. It's and really gives you a picture of what the war was like in a way that's pretty well rounded. That, you know, at the time there were movies and TV shows that kind of went both ways, where either the Rambo action types, but then you have Platoon, which was really dire, and things like that. But I love O'Brien's prose. I love his grasp on the language and the characters and the way they acted and the way they talked. And he really knows how to get to a reader's feelings. There are a couple of stories in the book that are downright scary. There's one called The Sweetheart of the Chong Tra Bong, which I never stop thinking about, which is this guy sneaks his girlfriend into Vietnam to be with him, and she basically goes feral, or, you know, like disappears into the jungle. It is frightening. It's like a piece of horror, and it's really good. And like one of the last stories is this beautiful story about this girl he knew who had cancer, and it's just like it's weirdly intimate in a way that I wouldn't have expected a book about, like, you know, the Nam to be, and having somebody who covered, I did cover this in an episode of the Nam in Country. And it seems like, just like with All Quiet on the Western Front, so many of these stories are like universal in a way. And yeah, I just always love this. So like I said, I don't know if this qualifies as historical fiction, but like it was, this and All Quiet were the first two novels I thought of when I thought of historical fiction, and All Quiet was on my top five. So this is, The Things He Carried has to be mentioned.
Okay. You wouldn't consider the short stories?
I think it could, there's a Venn diagram that kind of overlaps in places. So, but yeah, I also don't read a ton of historical fiction. So I need to
Sure. Yeah. I've read that. I'll say, mm-hmm. I enjoyed it, but yeah, it's definitely a hard read in terms of emotional beats. But yeah, I think you and I have, kind of bonded over the fact that we both find the Vietnam War like an interesting event in history. And yeah. So watching or reading media about that is something that I will do. I don't know why it's that one for me. I don't know, but it's just one that I find fascinating. And so I enjoyed it, but yeah, it's hard. So, another hard novel, is The Nightingale by Kristen Hannah. It takes place during World War II in France. And it's really about this relationship between these two sisters, where one, the younger one, is kind of seen as, you know, someone who doesn't take things seriously and messes up a lot. And the older one has a lot of responsibilities, and they end up playing really important roles during World War II. The younger one ends up being a spy. She is Nightingale. And the older one has to house a Nazi officer in her house. And she has a young son, I think, at the time. Kristen Hannah, you will know, Tom, on once you read her book. But she, because you have the one about the great unknown or whatever, that's called About Alaska. She really wrecks you with what happens. And this was just like a page turner. It was really interesting. The setting with World War II was interesting to see these sisters that love each other, but also have trouble with each other. So they might not like each other at all times. Seeing, you know, romance blossom in two different ways. The struggles that both of them go through, and then how upsetting, absolutely upsetting, that final scene is. I won't even say. I was melancholic for several days after, but I really enjoyed this. When I read it, I just could not put it down. I'm thinking about where I was when I was reading it, and it's probably my favorite of hers. I've read maybe 4 or 5. Kind of need like years break from her. But highly recommend, but also prepare yourself.
Yeah, The Great Alone is staring at me right across the room. I'm looking at my bookcase. So if I like that, I might give that one a go. Cool. All right. Well, I'm gonna have you go first to the next one. It's nonfiction.
Nonfiction. Stamped from the Beginning, The Definitive History of Racist Ideas in America by Ibram X. Kendi. Nonfiction is not typically my genre. However, when I recognize that I have a gap in my knowledge or of things that are relevant to today, sociopolitically, I will try to educate myself rather than sitting in my ignorance. And this was something I read, I think it was 2020. Mm-hmm. I think that was about the time. I remember I was a COVID screener. And this was late, but, you know, better late than never. And to have everything just like together there on the page to go from start to finish, I think is really eye-opening. I was never a person who was thinking that America wasn't built on a racist foundation.
Yeah.
But to see in this how much that it's like it threaded in the soil and in the DNA of this country, I think is really startling. And then just also learning a lot about the different eras and learning about new people and new, you know, I'll call them heroes. From that as well, just really powerful and helped push me, you know, on my journey to become an anti-racist.
I have a copy of that book actually on my bookcase here, and I remember really enjoying it as well. It was enlightening. Enlightening in the same ways that Howard Zinn's A People's History of the United States was to me when I first read that as well. On a, you know, kind of like putting that in there and stuff. So yeah, I remember, I would recommend that. And I know you've read this other book too. It's not my pick, but just to recommend another one that goes along with this, The Color of Law.
Yeah.
Which is about housing discrimination. It's, mm-hmm. That's another one. It's again, it's things you knew existed, but you're right. There's a duty to dive deeper into them and really, really experience, like, see the whole picture as opposed to just kind of like facts on a page. So no, Kendi's book is really, it's really well written. It is long though.
Yes.
It gets a little, and it feels long in places. Mm-hmm. But it's very well done. All right. This is a really hard category for me because I read a lot of nonfiction in a lot of different areas. And I if I'm looking to my right, I have a leaning bookcase in the center which has like coffee table books and a couple of Wonder Woman prints and sketches and stuff. That's my wife's office in here. On the left, I have a bunch of fiction and a few memoir, but on the right, I have under the shelf of poetry, I have like 2.5 shelves of nonfiction books. And it's I've got entertainment, I have sports, I have travel, I have history. It was really hard to narrow down like what do I pick from nonfiction and such? Because I had like essay collections, like the essays of E.B. White and Chuck Klosterman's Sex, Drugs, and Cocoa Puffs. Entertainment stuff like oh, You Couldn't Ignore Me If You Tried, which is about the John Hughes films by Susanna Gora. I have Our Band Could Be Your Life by Michael Azered, which is about 80s hardcore and punk scene. I have sports ones like The Bad Guys One, which is about the 86 Mets. I have travel, Bill Bryson, etc. I went with a history related one, and it's a lot smaller of a scale than your Kendi one. The honorable mention here would be Alan Higginbotham's recent book Challenger, which is about the Space Shuttle Challenger disaster and the space program, which was really, really well written, exhaustively researched, and for somebody who was 9 years old when the Challenger blew up, it felt very personal in places. But the one that I've come back to a lot, and a warning on this for anybody who does want to read it because it is horrific, is Dave Cullen's book Columbine. Dave Cullen was a reporter for the Denver Post and did a lot of the coverage, the local coverage of the Columbine High School massacre in 1999. And he gets into the background of everything and digs pretty deep and does this exhaustive look at the lives of the two people who committed that massacre, and then the day of, and then the fallout and things. There was a chapter added in another edition, a paperback edition, kind of an update chapter after it had come out. And I have the hardcover, so I one of my friends had the paperback. I just borrowed it just to read the chapter. But Cullen writes the book well, reports the book, researches it exhaustively, and it's harrowing. But what's really important too is because you don't want to necessarily read about a school shooting, but knowing how much misinformation came out from the Columbine massacre, and how to this day people have this assumption that these two kids were bullied and all these things, and that those things keep happening as far as like when they talk about it, and the role that wasn't the case, and the role our culture of guns played. There was a the Michael Moore movie Bowling for Columbine talks about that as well. Like thinking about like how this just keeps happening as well, and without getting too much into it. And I think Cullen did one about Parkland as well, which I haven't read. But Columbine it's tough. It is a very tough read, especially if you're old enough to have remembered the Columbine High School massacre. I was in college at the time. I was a senior in college. But yeah, I picked this up, and it's not gawking at a car accident, right? That's not why you read it. And he doesn't treat it as that. He gives it the sensitivity and the gravitas it needs. And I think it's an outstanding book, and I would recommend that.
I this
Yeah,
is
it's tough
something
to
that,
follow. Yeah.
yeah, I don't know. I don't know what to say
No, go
about
ahead. Go
that,
ahead.
but it sounds interesting. That's all I have to say. And I'm glad you said that it wasn't looking for shock factor, because I feel like
No.
sometimes with these Netflix series on like the serial killers and stuff, that you're kind of concerned, are we glamorizing, or are we trying to tell a story? Like, what's
Yeah.
happening here? So.
People talk about true crime brain,
Oh,
like
yeah.
how people think, yeah, and I'm not that into true crime. Sometimes it depends on what it is. If it's about a cult,
Yes, you are big on the cults.
Amanda Montrell's Cultish is a great book, by the way. I recommend that. It's about all that,
Yes.
like, yeah. I will take the first one, the next one. It is memoir slash autobiography slash biography. This was another one that, because I have a whole couple of shelves of memoirs and autobiographies and things like that. So I went with something that felt very personal because I'm a fan of this writer and director and the show he produced. But I'm going to mention three others that are kind of honorable mentions here really, really quickly. One, just because I can brag that I read it, because it's an enormous book, which is The Power Broker by Robert Caro. It's the biography of Robert Moses and all about what he did to New York City and Long Island in terms of urban renewal and all of these other things, where he would bulldoze entire neighborhoods and put up highways and just this whole extensive history of New York City from about the beginning of the 20th century all the way up until his death in like the 70s or early 80s. And it's a bit of a takedown of him, but it really is like, the idea of this person who, like, why did you have so much control and were able to so much shape so much? Elie Wiesel's Night, I can't mention. Do a memoir thing, or leave with at least mentioning, not me with at least mentioning Knight, because it is, I think it's, again, it's one of those things that you have to read. And then something that was more recently published and I love, that I just would recommend, which is I'm Glad My Mom Died by Jeanette McCurdy, which is her memoir of growing up as a child actress, but also with a horrifically abusive mother. So there's such a kind of warning on that. But this one that I chose for a memoir, it's essentially a collection of essays that is a chronological memoir of somebody's very awkward teenage years. It is funny. It is so funny. And it was the inspiration of for or is the source material in some way for one of my favorite TV shows of all time. The memoir is called Kick Me. It's by Paul Feig, who's a director and writer. He co-created the show Freaks and Geeks. And if you're familiar with that show, you're familiar with a number of the things that are in this book. It's him, like, from like all these stories about him at school. There's a whole hilarious thing about dodgeball. It has some really tender moments. The last chapter, where he goes to prom, has a really sweet ending to it. He is hilarious as a writer. He's the type of writer, a type of memoirist, essayist, where, like, I wish I could be that funny, because it's just it flows really well, and it's like, again, I could read it over and over and over again. It cracks me up every time that I read it. So I don't even know if you can find it in print these days. I have not looked at, I have not looked for it since I first bought it back like 20 years ago, 20, almost 25 years ago at this point. But if you can find Kick Me by Paul Feig, I highly recommend it. It is really, really funny.
Is that what I read?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Yes. No, I enjoyed those. Again, short story. Well, they're short essays, I guess. But yes, no, that was fun. Especially after watching Freaks and Geeks, which I think I did that around the same time.
All right. So for you, what do we have?
Yeah, honorable mention, Educated by Tara Westover,
Oh, I
which
love that
is
book.
Really raw. Hashtag trigger warnings. And Fun Home by Alison Bechdel. But I went with Wild from Lost to Found on the Pacific Crest Trail by Cheryl Strayed. Mainly because I just really find it a fascinating memoir. I think it's different. I mean, memoirs obviously about, I should have also said there's a food memoir that I can't remember its name as a honorary mention. But anyways, memoirs talk about your life or a certain maybe a boiling point in your life. And it's just really interesting that it's about her and grief over her losing her mother and also this trail that she tries to conquer. And I just found it really beautiful and tragic at the same time in those flashback scenes of her thinking about her mother, and then also just really triumphant of this woman soloing this trail and to see what she gets up to and how she basically goes from a noob to someone that people know who she is, and she's making friends and things. So I have enjoyed it both times that I've read it. And would recommend it, and had a lot of fun when we did our little sort of side trail on, oh, pun intended, on trails or memoirs involving traveling and sojourns.
I loved that book. I absolutely love that book. That's a great choice. Yeah.
Thank you.
So this has to be one of the hardest categories for you because it is romance.
My gosh.
And I need to Stella to just you have to narrow it down to one piece of smut, Stella.
One piece of and I don't even consider this smut, but again,
mine's not smut either, but go ahead.
Yeah. If this is formative, if my theme is formative, then I was thinking like, what is the romance that really formed me into, you know, a lover of romance and has gotten me to where I am today. And it's a bit of a cheat because it is a series, but this was very much what had gotten into me. But it's the Lakeshore Chronicles by Susan Wiggs. There are 11 books. And I had just happened upon it. Maybe I think someone I was definitely at band camp, which is funny to say. And a parent was reading, I think the second one, Winter at Willow Lake, and I just like picked it up and kind of flipped through it. I was like, oh, this is interesting, and then looked for the first one, and then it just like spiraled out of control from there. And it's definitely not like spice level is not what I'm currently reading or what is big right now. I definitely would say it's like warm, mildly hot. So if you are someone who would like it to be a bit tempered, I think you have it. Very story based and focusing on the relationships. And then because it's happening in a small town, it's so community centered as well. And the characters that this is the first time that I experienced this outside of comics, there's a continuity with this. So the characters that you're seeing, you know, you'll see them later, or the ones that might be in the first book, you'll, you know, see them later on, you know, as a couple and they're, you know, they've got a kid or something like that. And this was also the first time that I experienced seeing one particular character as a minor character growing up throughout the series and then finally getting her own book, which was really satisfying. So that was definitely what put me on the track of romance novels. So I have to give it up to Susan Wiggs.
Cool. All right. Mine's book, I'm pretty sure I know you read this because I know I loaned this to you.
Oh.
Because I don't read a lot of romance, to be completely honest with you. I've read what we read for the smut episode. Yeah. I've read Helena Greer's three books in her Carrington's trilogy. We had covered Seasons of Love, and I have the other two. I just haven't read them yet. They're staring at me from the other side of the room here. But I chose one that actually won at least a couple of book awards, etc., and is way more of a literary, although it has its steamy scenes and stuff like that. And it's a really, really good LGBTQIA plus book. And that is the novel Last Night at the Telegraph Club.
Oh, yes.
So let me read the Goodreads description because that way people can kind of get it. Because me trying to describe it would not do it justice. A story of love and duty set in San Francisco's Chinatown during the Red Scare. Quote, that book, it was about two women and they fell in love with each other. And then Lily asked the question that had taken root in her, that was even now unfurling its leaves and demanding to be shown the sun. Quote, have you ever heard of such a thing? 17-year-old Lily Hu can't remember exactly when the question took root, but the answer was in full bloom the moment she met Kathleen Miller. She and Kathleen Miller walked under the flashing neon sign of a lesbian bar called the Telegraph Club. American 1954 is not a safe place for two girls to fall in love, especially not in Chinatown. Red Scare paranoia threatens everyone, including Chinese Americans like Lily. With deportation looming over her father, despite his hard-won citizenship, Lily and Kath risk everything to let their love see the light of day. So it's a bit of historical fiction. It is a romance book. There's a love story between these two, but it really does take into the account like the context of everything. It is really sad in places. It is very tough to read in places because it's just like what's happening and the struggle that the two of them go through seems very real and lived in. Even though the writer is not from the 1950s, Melinda Lowe is a contemporary writer. And she actually has a follow-up to this that was just more of a regular romance, but did kind of like tie into this in some way, tangentially. But no, I really loved this. I had to read this for like a book club at work. We were trying to figure out, like we were reading books that were different voices, you know, different authors and things like that. And the librarian picked this one. And I was just, I couldn't put it down. And it was like, you know, like I said, I'm not a romance novel reader, and it's not like a smutty romance novel. It is more literary, but like, yeah, it's just, the characters are so well written and the feelings between them are so genuine that you're rooting for them, even though you know how hard it's going to be. Lily's entrance into this world that she had never even thought of, and being that kind of like person who's coming, trying to come out and trying to realize who you are in a time where you could literally be put in jail for it. And it's beautifully written as well. I really highly, highly recommend it.
I enjoyed it. Yes, Tom lent it to me.
I remember because I read it. I was like, you'd like this.
Yeah, I very much enjoyed it. And yeah, I always worry about, because what was that, 1950s?
1954, I think it said in the description. Yeah, so the McCarthy era.
Yeah, about, you know, what's it going to be like? But a good Bildungsroman.
Yes, Bildungsroman.
Yeah. I really enjoyed those characters and them finding each other. And then there's a flash forward and they're together, which is very lovely. So thank you for that epilogue.
Yeah. So, all right. Our next thing is short stories. This one was weird for me because I teach a lot of different short stories. And there are some times where I like authors I can think of and I can't think of like a specific story. I've loved stories by Shirley Jackson and Ray Bradbury, Flannery O'Connor, Harlan Ellison, Laurie Moore, Sarah Pinsker, Joyce Carol Oates. If I'm going to rattle off four of my all-time favorites, and I'll kind of save the Poe is really good, by the way.
Edgar Allan.
Okay. Yeah. If I'm gonna rattle off five, I'm gonna rattle off my top five because I teach all of these. Number five would be Lamb to the Slaughter by Roald Dahl. Woman kills her husband by hitting him over the head with a leg of lamb and then shoves it in the oven. The police eat it. I gave it away. Patient Zero by Tananarive Due, who is a journal from the point of view of a 12-year-old boy who is stuck in quarantine because he is the carrier of an apocalyptic plague, and they've been trying to get a vaccine out of his blood, and the world is essentially ending around this. It's a really sad but very, very well-told story from the point of view of a kid. Hills Like White Elephants by Ernest Hemingway, which I do not like Hemingway. But this is an outstanding story. It's a very, very brief story. It's like six pages or something in a book. You are essentially eavesdropping on a conversation between two people at a train station in Spain. And the topic of the conversation is never explicitly stated. And you kind of have to like read between the lines and things like that. And it's a really, really good example of dialogue, of succinct prose. It's written very well. I recommend that one. And the top two, number two is Time and Again by Brees DJ Pancake. One night of a man driving a snowplow over a mountain pass in West Virginia, and it is implied he has been picking up hitchhikers and killing them and feeding to his pigs at home. And the whole suspense is whether or not he's going to kill the kid who has just gotten into the truck with him. Again, very, very short story, really suspenseful. But the one I keep coming back to, and again, this is hard to find because I found it in a textbook of all things, is called Teenage Wasteland, and it's by Ann Tyler, whose most famous book is probably The Accidental Tourist, because it was made into a movie in the 80s, and Gina Davis won Best Supporting Actress for it, I think, in 1988. It is about this. It's from the third person point of view from this mother named Daisy, and her kid Donnie keeps getting into trouble at school. And she's going through this whole thing of like, you know, what did I do wrong, et cetera. And then she is convinced to hire this tutor guy named Cal, who seems to be less like a tutor and more one of those guys who like wants to be this kid's friend, and things get worse and worse. And it deals with the whole idea of teenage runaways. It deals with her not being like confident in herself and her parenting, what goes through your head when you're trying to raise a teenager. And it's really complicated. And every year we read it, I ask my kids, like, whose fault is this story with the ending of the story? And they're like, it's everybody's. And we talk about like how every bit of this leads to the main character running away at the end. And it's a really good, it was written, I think, and published in like 1983, but it still really works for today. And it's a great character piece of sympathetic and unsympathetic characters. And you're like, you get into it because like, I know this kid. We've all known this kid at some point or another. And it's a really, really great, great piece and a very realistic fiction. And I don't know what collection it was in because, like I said, I found it in an 11th grade textbook a long time ago and just made a copy of it. But if you can find it, I would highly recommend reading Teenage Wasteland by Ann Tyler. Stella, what do you have?
Yeah, just a collection. I went by author. Just Flannery O'Connor is
Oh,
my
yeah.
favorite short story writer, to be honest. I have her collected short stories. And yeah, it was something that I read in college at a Realism in the South course, an NWAR course, and just really latched on just how she is able to juxtapose the grotesque and the beautiful together. And some like crazy situations that also go on in some of those stories as well. So she's someone that I will probably always say is my favorite short story novelist. I guess I should have thought of favorites from other people, but I'll
No,
just
it's
stick
okay.
with that.
I think I have so many favorites because I teach a lot of short stories, or I'm always looking for short stories to teach. I do love Flannery O'Connor. In fact, I grabbed one of her collections at a recent book sale, so I have to read that when I get the chance. Okay, next up is YA. Stella.
Tough one,
This
huh?
was tough. This was tough for me.
Yeah.
Because it always seems to change.
It
But
does. Yeah, it does
go ahead.
always seem to change. I would say, though, in recent years that I will just give this number one. And I mean, if I said my honorable mentions, it'd probably be a list. So I'm just going to say The Poet X by Elizabeth Acevedo. As we covered this a couple months ago, and I spoke about how I just immediately fell in love with this during my one of my grad school courses, and I just find it so powerful. It was the first, no, it was the second. I'll say it's the first novel in verse. We did do a sort of a short story in verse by Jason Reynolds. But yeah, my first
Okay.
novel in verse, and yeah, different character demographic, than I had been used to reading, which I think is lovely. And again, providing that sliding glass door and that window, and just yeah, a lot of tough topics that pop up, and a really cool character in Ciamara.
You know, that actually was my pick as well.
Whoa.
I will give you my second in a
Okay.
second, but I have two other honorable mentions. I do want to mention The Outsiders because we both love that book. And like I said, the YA thing seems to change as they always seem to be fairly recent. I also want to mention a book by Gay Paulsner called The Memory of Things. It's a novel about this kid and he finds this it's in the midst of 9/11 and he finds this girl who really has no memory of who she is and she's like wearing angel wings from a costume or something, and eventually, like, who is this girl? And he's living with his are his parents okay? He's living with his uncle, and his uncle's disabled. And it's this beautifully written story about being in Brooklyn and Lower Manhattan and around the time in 2001 in New York City. So I highly recommend that. But mine is another book that I know you wrote. I think you read for the same course because I think you borrowed my copy, just like with the Poet X, which is Firekeeper's Daughter by Angeline Bouley. So I will read the description for this as well. As a biracial, unenrolled tribal member and the product of a scandal, Donnie Fontaine never has never quite fit in, both in her hometown on the nearby Ojibwe reservation. When her family is struck by tragedy, she puts her dreams on hold to care for her fragile mother. The only bright spot is meeting Jamie, the charming new recruit on her brother's hockey team. After she witnesses a shocking murder that thrusts her into a criminal investigation, she agrees to go undercover. But the deceptions and deaths keep piling up, and soon the threat strikes too close to home. How far will she go to protect her community if it means tearing apart the only world she's ever known? So this is like a suspenseful book. It has a bit of mystery to it. I was not expecting 21 Jump Street like 50 pages in, as I told my librarian. But it is also this window into Native American culture and what it is like to be a mix of mixed race in Native American culture, and you know, and like how the politics of a tribe work, and things like that. And that layered on top of essentially a murder mystery really gave this a lot of depth. It's a really long book. It's like 500-600 pages. But it didn't feel like that. And I remember like being like really gripped by this book. There's a couple of moments in the book I was like, oh, I didn't want to happen. But at the same time, all the way up into the end, I was just intrigued and I really felt for this character. And again, like it really opened doors to like, you know, the struggles of somebody who is Native American and but also like half white and dealing with like, okay, like, you know, what is it like to be in both of these worlds? Really, really great book.
Yes, I did enjoy this. Again, another, you know, demographic that I think is not written about very often, but I think it's getting better with Indigenous people. And yes, I had no idea really what was happening until I think that first part break. Mm-hmm. That's when kind of things like something shocking happens.
Yeah.
And then I agree with you, of course, about, you know, one of these things did not need to have to happen.
Anymore. Uh-huh. I know exactly what we're talking about.
Yeah. Even though the author gives an explanation as to why she puts it in there, I'm just like, but you could have not done it.
Yeah. Anyway.
To try to go against the grain. Yeah. But no, I recommend this book as well.
Okay. I'm going to pick the first one out of the next one. That's science fiction. This was hard. So like, I just read the Star Wars Expanded Universe. There you go. Yeah. Or the Star Trek one. You know, I've read a lot of Expanded Universe sci-fi. I've mentioned how much I love the War of the Worlds. The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy is another one we covered that I absolutely love. But one that it's kept jumping out at me, and I was like, and I have to reread this because it's been a while, but I remember... this is a book that emotionally wrecked me, and I recommend it to a lot of people. And that is Never Let Me Go by Kazuo Ishiguro.
Oh,
I don't want to get into what the science fiction aspect of it is, because it shows up a ways into the novel, and I want you kind of want to go in clean before you discover like what's going on. But it is it's a dystopian piece where a young woman is being kind of subjected to, like, it seems like scientific experiments and things, and we discover who she is and why. It's also a love story. She's being kind of kept in this like a boarding school or a home or something, and she keeps dreaming of like a beach. And so it's a kind of a quest for that. And it's this really intricately done character piece that, again, is just at the end, it's like so emotionally wrecking. But it's a beautiful book, as incredibly sad as it is. And I'm not doing the description justice because I'm dancing around the big thing that is the centerpiece of the book, because it literally is revealed to you like maybe after the first part. So you're reading like 100 pages or so, and you finally get to like what's going on. You're like, oh crap, and I don't want to give that away. But I really, really read Never Let Me Go, but be warned, you will probably cry.
I saw the film, mm-hmm. which stars Andrew Garfield.
Keira Knightley too,
and I think maybe yes. And thinking of her name here, Promising Young Woman. Why can't I remember? Married to the lead singer of Hold on one moment. Carey Mulligan.
Carey Mulligan.
Yes. So boy, yes. I actually recently got that, by recently I mean in the summer, mm-hmm. on an Amazon book sale. And I was thinking about picking that shortly required reading.
I'm up for it.
Okay, well just be ready. I've never read it, but you know, the movie I think Oh, okay. So that's all I can say about that. My science fiction I already mentioned was Frankenstein.
Okay. Any others you want to mention from science fiction that just kind of jumped out at you?
You know, I did really like Galapagos by
Vonnegut.
yeah. Because I did not like, I guess it's time to revisit it to give it one more go. But I did not like Slaughterhouse-Five, which I think is on like the best of lists when it comes to science fiction. So I just thought, ooh, I don't think I like Vonnegut. And then I read a couple of his other stories and I thought, oh, maybe I do like Vonnegut. And I enjoyed our discussion on Galapagos.
Yeah, Brett has my copy of Slaughterhouse-Five because they were reading it for a class. So I haven't read
Oh.
Slaughterhouse-Five since college, so I might have to revisit that as well. All right, next up is just kind of another step away from science fiction, which is the speculative fiction slash
Ooh.
dystopian genre.
Yes.
Stella, what's your pick here?
Hopefully this is allowed. I'm going with the Hunger Games series.
That was
Is
on
that
my
okay?
list of it, yeah. So
Okay.
that wasn't my pick, but that was on my short list.
Okay, just to be sure that it counts,
Yes.
since you put dystopian, by Suzanne Collins. I'm not going to pick one, also I'll just say the series, just like I did with the Lakeshore Chronicles and everything. We covered two of them. And oh yeah, didn't we make a pact that we were going to cover the new one when it comes out, which is
Yeah, I
Gamage's novel?
pre-ordered
Yes,
it.
I have as well. I think that's March or April, so whichever one
Yeah.
that is. But I love it obviously because of its connection with Roman history. It's scary, obviously, and just a great cast of characters and really intriguing, and potentially one of the reasons why I fell in love with YA literature, or like gave it a shot. I think this was like my biggest foray, even though I guess technically I had been reading YA literature when we consider about older novels, but like this revitalized young adult literature. So yeah, Hunger Games will always be up there for me.
All right. I had thought of 1984. I was like, I don't know. It was, and honestly, it came down to two books, and it's still a toss-up between the two of them. But I will say at this point, in second place is The Handmaid's Tale, but in
Oh.
first place is Station 11,
Oh yes,
which
that was a consideration.
I love that book. And you were the one who introduced me to it because we were reading it for the show. And I've now piloted it in my classes to it. And I've had kids who love it. I just, 'cause it was a totally different take on everything and very, very real. And I liked the questions it brought up about, your place in the world and how that changes, things about, religion and cults and following and the speculative nature of things. And I felt that it had a little more hope to it than a lot of dystopian speculative fiction had. And I think sometimes you need that from a book. And it was a lot more, slightly more, it I don't want, gentle is not the way to put it, but it's not as brutal as like the Hunger Games books or like 1984 is, et cetera. And The Handmaid's Tale, because The Handmaid's Tale is a brutal, brutal book. But yeah, so Station 11, I really, that's the top of mine.
Handmaid's Tale is no longer speculative fiction.
I know.
Next.
Yes. Okay. Epics.
Oh,
I have
epics. Yes.
prose or poetry.
Okay.
And I have a feeling that I know your pick, and I have a feeling you might know mine. But I'm going first because I think that's the order here. And while as much as I love Beowulf, if I have to say my favorite epic is The Odyssey by Homer, which I'm reading right now in ninth grade English, so I teach it every year. But no, Odysseus and his trials to get back home, Telemachus trying to find his father, Penelope waiting for her husband, the raging double standard that goes on with her husband and Circe. But all of it, Homer giving us a very, very human epic hero, setting up rules for things like sequels and other storytelling devices that we still adhere to this day. It's like literally a foundational text of Western literature. And I think that I mean, it's a book I'm going to choose at some point for this show, so I'm not going to get too much into it. I love the Odyssey. I love the Emily Wilson translation. I cannot recommend it enough. So there, yeah. Odysseus.
Mine's Gilgamesh. No, I'm just kidding. Mine is, of course, Virgil's Aeneid.
Yeah.
Whether it is in English or Latin. Obviously, I prefer the Latin, given that's the original language, and I can actually read it. But yeah, I love it ever so much. The beauty of the language and the story itself, and you know that it is, it's Romans, you know, Rome's, well, it's a propaganda item, but it's also, you know, their epic that they have their own, and they don't have to keep referring back to Homer, which I can appreciate. Yeah. And yeah, it's also you know, I like to think about Juno / Hera a lot, because she is, I mean, talk about complex heroines, just like Scarlett O'Hara, just someone that is like super complex. And, you know, she's the antagonist of that. But it's like, oh, you know, she has some reasons for why she's doing what she's doing. But yeah, it's my favorite.
Shocking. No, I knew that's what it was going to be.
Yeah.
Okay. So you go first on this one. Fiction in translation.
Yeah. So originally I had the Girl with the Dragon Tattoo series, posthumously published, originally by Stieg Larsson. And then I was like, oh man, but The Iliad has had me transfixed for a while now, so I think I am going to go by that. So The Iliad by Homer, but translated specifically by Emily Wilson. I just, yeah, I loved it when I read it. Obviously, I'm doing Dear Reader season 3 on it, so it's kind of not very far from my mind anyways, but it's been interesting because I've talked with a couple people recently at work that spoken about The Iliad, and they're like struggling through it and have like started in summer and still haven't made it through. And I'm saying things like, you should try Emily Wilson's, you know, just start from scratch. It might be easier. But yeah, I really cannot speak highly enough of her and this translation, especially if you are one that might prefer the Odyssey over the Iliad and just had struggles with that. I think give this one more go and see if you can do it. I have already said that I think because of my bias with the Trojans and with Aeneas, that I do prefer the Iliad over the Odyssey. Mm-hmm. I've got to give the Odyssey another go, I guess. I feel like I've read it 2 or 3 times, but I do need to give Emily Wilson's translation a go. But yeah. So that is that's my number one.
All right. I had thought of I've mentioned Beowulf. I love Seamus Heaney's translation of Beowulf. I thought of older novels from the 19th century that I've read that were translated. An honorable mention to Crime and Punishment by Dostoevsky. The only reason that it's not my favorite is because I haven't read it in almost 30 years, so I have to give it another go, but I do remember really liking it in college. But the book I would say that, like, okay, this book was written in another language, it was translated, and I absolutely love it, is Les Miserables. I mean, it's such a great book, and it's got the tangents that he even goes into on the Napoleonic Wars and everything don't bother me the way that, like, the whale crap bothers me in Moby Dick. But I'm familiar with the musical. I saw the musical on Broadway when I was 17. And I could hear the musical as I was reading it, but the Jean Valjean and Cosette and Javert and these characters, again, Hugo gives us an epic story with really well-developed, fleshed-out characters that you end up caring about over the whole lifetime of Jean Valjean and his daughter, so to speak, et cetera, et cetera. I don't know. It's a really, really just well done, moving classic of a book. Jean Valjean. All right. Horror, which is me. I have read a lot of horror lately. I didn't realize this until I was like reading something last night and finishing it. And I was like, wow, this is like the fifth or sixth horror novel I read. Shout out to a couple of favorite authors on mine. Grady Hendrix is an author that I absolutely love. He wrote My Best Friend's Exorcism, The How to Sell a Haunted House, A Horror Store. I just picked up his new one, The Witchcraft for Wayward Girls. There's Tananarive Due, who wrote the short story I mentioned earlier. She wrote The Good House, which is a really, really good book about demonic possession and such. But I had to go with a formative book in the genre of horror for me. Really the first horror novel I ever read by the Horror Master. It is a Stephen King novel.
In your refrigerator?
No, it's not The Shining.
Oh.
I'm telling you. What allowed me to read this book, or how my parents allowed me to read
Oh.
this book when I was between the summer of seventh and eighth
Oh
grade.
dear, the
I was
balloon.
13. Yes, the book is it.
Oh,
And
Tom.
the reason it's so formative, it was my first ever horror novel, but it really was, in a big way, my first adult book. You know, I've been reading since I was a little kid, and I read a lot of different. Some scary things, like Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark, and some of the other things, and Choose Your Own Adventure. And I was too old for the R.L. Stine, Christopher Pike era. I was just a couple of years younger than me. But my parents had like every Stephen King book at that point. And it was just sitting on the shelf, and the movie with Tim Curry was coming out that fall. And I picked it up, and I just read it, and didn't get like half of it. You know, I knew it was racy. I knew that the whole thing at the end, I was like, what the heck is this? And still, I'm like, we don't talk about the ending of the movie, of the book, but the Pennywise and like all these things, and how well it's woven into it. It's an enormous book. And then I reread it. I think it's episode two, or it's episode two or three of Pop Culture Affidavit is actually about it. And yeah, to this day, I'm like, this is one of the most important novels of my life because it put me on the path of reading toward more adult books. It's also really good too.
I've not, except for that scene.
Except for that scene. We don't talk about that scene.
I see. I haven't read it. I haven't read
Yeah.
it. I don't know that it'll be, because that'll take some time. Isn't that
Yeah.
over 1,000 pages?
It's like 1,500, 1,600 pages.
Yeah,
We all
yeah.
float down here, Stella.
I know. I know.
Okay, next up is Mystery and Suspense. Stella, what you got?
Wait, how could you? I didn't even
Oh
think
wait,
you
shoot,
had
horror. I'm
horror.
sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm
You're
sorry.
trying to dismiss me like that?
No, go. It's late.
A
Go.
slight cheat, but this is gothic horror. Rebecca.
Oh
Rebecca
yes.
by Daphne du Maurier. We talked about it on here. As I said, gothic romance, gothic horror is one of my favorite genres. And yeah, just love the is Rebecca around? Is her ghost there? What's happening here? What's the creepy lady the head of the house doing? And the mystery that, I mean, it's technically also a mystery too, that kind of unravels as you go throughout. But there's just this sense of dread throughout the entire novel that I would consider it a gothic horror. So I do love Rebecca.
I love that book. I absolutely loved that book. I'm so glad that we were, I was trying to figure a way to put that on in this episode, and I'm so glad you did that.
There you go. Yeah.
All
And
right.
I remember being really nervous to mention it because I think it was after Jane Eyre, so I was worried that you're going to get upset, but I was really happy that you enjoyed that
Yeah.
book.
All right. Now we're on Mystery and Suspense.
Now we're
Stella,
on
what's
Mystery
yours?
and Suspense. Yes. I think honorable mention to a Karen M. McManus YA novel called The Cousins. I think I've read nearly all of hers, except for one. Then there were two. I can't remember. Two. One of Us is Lying is like one of her first. So you may have heard of that one.
Right. I think it's Barbara's copy.
Yes, I think that is what happened. I remember there was like a cat unicorn
Yes.
bookmark in there.
Bookmark.
Yes, and I picked up The Cousins, I think, on my trip to Cape Cod, maybe to read it, and loved this one. I feel like it's the best one of all of hers. I gave it 5 stars, and that follows couple, well, follow some cousins going to their grandmother's estate, but their grandmother had disowned their parents. So it's like kind of suspicious what's going on, and just things happened I did not see coming. It was really interesting. But my actual pick is The Curious Incident of the Dog at the Nighttime by Mark Haddon. Another Rory Gilmore's book list. So hashtag Gilmore Girls. We did this on this particular show. Again, a demographic that, you know, I would not necessarily like immediately think about, oh, this is going to be a star, you know, star of a book. Uh-huh. And here we are and getting more representation and the cleverness of the designs within to really show what Christopher is going through and how he thinks and perceives the world is really interesting.
Yeah. This, I have to admit, this is a genre that is like underrepresented in my reading. And I was trying to struggle. I was struggling to think of like a lot of books, and I've read a few more recently. I read The Last Thing You Told Me recently, which I thought was really, really good. I do have,
what was The Last Thing You Told Me?
I don't remember. Okay. I do enjoy the book. It was a very good book. And then there are some others that I think I've read bits and pieces here. And then I've read a couple others that I just did not like too. I do have one. I think that when I was kind of, again, like kind of, I come back to this, I want to reread it, and I come back to just some of the scenes in it. I'm just like, it's harrowing in places. Before I get to my pick, though, I need to mention one of the books that teaches us about suspense as little children, because it's one of my favorite books of all time, which is There's a Monster at the End of This Book, starring lovable furry old Grover. It's a golden book where, like, he's the one, he's always screaming, you turn the page, don't turn the page. There's a monster at the end of the book. So I just want to get that in there because I love Grover and I love that book. But the book I'm talking about is Gone Girl. Flynn. This
book. Put away your wine bottles.
This book, man. This is like, both of these characters are just awful people, but it's so compelling. And like, I'm on every single word, like halfway through the novel, I'm like, oh crap. It just took a turn that I didn't expect. And I remember, I think I read it inside of a day. I was like, it's really good. I want to reread it too. So I have to find a copy. But yeah, I just remember this being really, really good. And I actually never saw the movie. Probably should remedy that, but I do remember this, and I've heard Sharp Objects is also very good, so I'll have to pick that up. But this is a genre that I have to explore a little bit more. But yeah, so for right now, it's Gone Girl.
Rosamund Pike,
yes,
one of my crushes. Yeah, she's in it. I read it before I went to see the film, and I was waiting for that scene with the wine bottle. Uh-huh. And I was looking around, seeing if anyone was also ready, and I don't think the audience was ready for what was about to happen and befall them. So just be prepared for
that. Huh? David Fincher directed that, right?
Yes, I believe.
Okay,
so.
Yeah, cool.
Yep. Yes, a novel that I did consider mentioning. Mm-hmm. Yes, a good one, and yes, rather disturbing.
All right, we got three more categories. Next up is play or drama. And I think that's where I start. I'm going to briefly kind of divide this into, I'm going to say, if I'm going with Shakespeare, the tragedy would be Macbeth and the comedy would be Twelfth Night. I just needed to get that out there. But my all-time favorite play is A Raisin in the Sun, which we covered. And it's just such a, first of all, beautifully written play, powerful, topical, really digs into it. It's a piece of history. So like it's historical fiction that you would do along the lines of what we were talking about, The Color of Law and Stamp from the Beginning, et cetera, and that you get a more, sometimes fiction helps tell that story in a way that we can start to understand it better and understand the human side of it, that just kind of reading about it from that historian's point of view, or through the lens of a historian, as good as it is, might not get it. And it's a play about race. It's a play about your dignity. It's a play about your feeling of your masculinity, of your family and things. And I think Hansberry is just, whose life was cut way too short by breast cancer, wrote like an absolute masterpiece of a play.
Mine is The Glass Menagerie by Tennessee Williams.
Which that was episode covered. two, I think.
Oh, really taking it
I think it
back.
was episode two.
Yeah, of course, a memory play about a family in St. Louis during the Great Depression and yeah, weight of family expectations, I would say, and kind of working through those. But yes, it is a beloved, beloved play. Of course, honorable mention to My Guy Julius Caesar by William Shakespeare. And Macbeth is also up there for me too.
So we have two more categories, and they are very, very familiar territory for us because they are both graphic novel categories. We are going to start with graphic novels that are non-superhero, and we're going with OGNs for this one, so they're not like trades or series or anything like that, because I certainly could put, we could wax poetic about Strangers in Paradise. Or any of Terry Moore's stuff. Stella and I covered a show, a series called Nothing Better years ago. Students at college, I really loved that. So non-superhero, just OGN, and then the other one would be superhero, either OGN or trade. So it could be a collection. So Stella, why don't you start us off with your non-superhero pick, and then I'll give mine.
Non-superhero pick. Did think about Terry Moore a lot. I was thinking about Motor Girl, which I think
I
is,
like that. Yeah.
yeah, it's a great novel about, I would say, PTSD,
Yeah.
frankly, being in the military and kind of a different effect that, or it manifests in a different way than we ha may have seen in other forms of media. So I really appreciate that. But because my theme, of course, in this episode is formation and formative, which Tom did use it, so now he's trying to appropriate my culture.
Steal your thunder.
It's Persepolis by Marjane Satrapi, which I think we also covered on this
We
show.
did.
And this is because I would say that this officially is probably the first graphic, like literal graphic novel that I had read. We obviously I had read trades before. But this is something that I read at a class at university and really loved it. Just this self-contained, which it could have been a memoir pick, obviously, self-contained story, again about, I guess another theme is other cultures, or other people that are not white or cisgendered or heterosexual. Diversity is a good theme. Yeah, learning more about Iran, which is another area that I'm interested in, and just yeah, a completely different experience from my own life experience. So another glass, another window and sliding glass door, and really appreciated doing a deep dive in an academic setting with this graphic novel.
That was on my short list, along with March,
Oh yeah.
and Art Spiegelman's Mouse, which is another classic in the graphic novel way. I went with something that's a lot more personal of a story for the author, and intimate in a number of ways, both horrific, and beautiful, because it's beautifully drawn. And we actually discussed this one, and I because I was like. And this is hard because I have a lot of graphic novels, and some
You
of them are,
don't say.
yeah, some of them are series. Like there's the Reckless series by Ed Brubaker, which is really, really good. And I mentioned Terry Moore already, a couple other memoirs, but the director Kent State is really good. The Best We Can Do, which was about Vietnamese immigrants, but I kept coming back to Blankets, and I remembered really, really. I've read that twice. We covered it years ago, and then I've read it another time, and it's a sad, sad book, in many ways, but it's also beautifully done, and it is a Bildungsroman in some ways or another. But yeah, I just remember it. I remember it being beautiful and like very quiet in these ways and stuff like that. And I just it really affected me the more than I think I realized, especially the love story aspect of it, because it was so heartbreaking in places. Should give honorable mention to Raina Telgemeier, by the way, because her stuff
Oh,
is really, really
sure.
good.
Yeah.
All right. I will go next with the trade, and that means that you will finish us up. So when we talk about trade paperbacks and we talk about collections and things, and Stella's shocked that I am not picking a new Teen Titans.
I am shocked.
Something like the Judas Contract, which I always will recommend to somebody. But I have to go. You want to talk about formative. I have to go with the thing that really got me into the idea of a comic book universe, because like prior to this, the only comic book experience I had had was like with G.I. Joe and the Transformers. And I'd started buying Batman in about 1990. And I borrowed a copy of issue 12 of this series, right? Or my friend just gave me a bunch of comics that he had, I think it was, because I ended up with his copy of issue 12 of this series. And I painstakingly over the course of a couple of years kept going back to my LCS to find the rest of this book, and it took me a few years, and I finally found it. I've read it so many times. My hardcover is signed by the writer, the artist, may he rest in peace, two of the inkers, and it is Crisis on Infinite Earths.
Oh my gosh.
I read issue 12 to start with. I read the last issue of the series. It was the first one I got. And then I had remembered seeing the Supergirl cover, and I got that, and I would just read it through, even though I didn't have all the issues. And I finally got all the issues and I read it through. And then when the hardcover came out in 1988, I paid a lot of money for it. And I've had, like I said, I have this signed by Marv Wolfman, George Perez, Jerry Ordway, and Mike DiCarlo. And I have all three volumes of the crossover. I actually have it in trade too, because I didn't want to keep reading my hardcover. So I bought a trade paperback version. And of course, we have it on DC Infinite. We can debate the effects of it. We can debate whether or not, you know, it worked, whether or not it was necessary, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It is like such an epic superhero story with all these different characters that like, and it's 40 years old at this point, and I can still go and read it, and it feels like I'm 13 again. And like trying to figure out who all these characters are and just being absorbed in this story about, you know, the Monitor and the Anti-Monitor and all these things. And I went into it as a noob, because I had, aside from like the Super Friends, right? Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman and stuff, I had no prior experience with the DCU. I managed to get sucked in, and I have not looked back. So yeah, Crisis in Infinite Earths, my all-time favorite. It's my all-time favorite comic book story, and it is, and that's the trade paperback that I would put in anybody's hand, because I just love it. Okay. You?
And yeah, honorable mention goes to Identity Crisis, which I guess another theme of my side of the show could be problematic picks. Which it is, but I really enjoyed that mystery. Mm-hmm. Obviously some bad things went down, but uh-huh. it's I think a really intriguing thought experiment as well. But my number one, which it was hard because I was communicating with Tom about, I'm having trouble thinking of something that's not a trick, because my go-to is always the same answer. And it's Batgirl Year One by Chuck Dixon, Scott Beatty, and Marcos Martin. And originally 9 issues, came out in, I think, 2009. And as the title says, it's Barbara's first year in the cape and cowl. And it's really what made me fall in love with Barbara. It's beautiful and it's really well written. And I think really captures the essence of her character and why I love her so much. And it's, again, another thing that I just will always recommend to somebody if they're looking for some sort of Batgirl thing. I'll mention that, and I'll mention The Flood by with Stephanie Brown by Brian Q. Miller. So it's my go-to. It's my girl.
Yeah. I have the collection that also has Robin Year One in it.
Oh, yeah.
And I have Robin Year One's really good, too. So that's an excellent, excellent pick. All right. So we are through this whole list, which will probably change the minute we get off this call.
Of course.
I'm going to hold off feedback for an episode because we are quite a ways in. So we'll read your feedback on recent episodes and episode 101, which is coming up with, well, it's Stella's pick. So finally, tell us, what are we reading as we start the next century of episodes?
Oh, yes. Required Reading is doing a crossover with Dear Reader Season 3, where Tom is going to guest star over there. And we're going to be reading and discussing the 1602 play by William Shakespeare. Troilus and Cressida.
Oh, interesting. I've never read that. All right. Well, cool. All right. Well, come back for that. And until then, thank you very much for listening, especially if you've been here from the beginning, 100 episodes. It's been outstanding, and I can't wait for the next 100. And take care.
Yeah, here's to another 100.
Good night.
Thanks for listening to Required Reading with Tom and Stella, which is brought to you by Two True Freaks. That's Two True Freaks. If you're interested in learning more about the books we've read or want to comment on the episode, follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/requiredreadingwithtomandstella.
If you would like to email us to comment on the episode or continue our discussion, you can reach us at requiredreadingcast@gmail.com. We will read every email we get on future episodes.
We're looking for more visibility, so if you liked this episode or the show in general, why not leave us a review on iTunes? Thanks again for listening, and come back next month for our next episode.